of them get quite annoyed with me. Of course, I can be senile myself. I do forget things sometimes. Sophie said, I'm always forgetting where I've left the car, or dialing a number and then forgetting who I'm phoning. Unfortunately, Veronica happened to walk out of the church at exactly the moment Sophie and Enigma were laughing. Her face contorted. Oh, Pet, don't pull faces like that, said Enigma. The wind might change. Grandma Enigma! Veronica looked enraged, and as if she might burst into tears. Veronica, began Sophie, not knowing what she was going to say, but feeling bad for her, because there had been some schoolgirl spite in Enigma's remark. Don't you talk to me, hissed Veronica. All around them, ears quivered as guests sensed interesting funeral conflict. That's enough now, Veronica, said Enigma sharply, looking as if she wanted to give Veronica a smack. I've really got to go, said Sophie desperately. Thank you so much for having me. I had a lovely time. Okay, I really must go. She practically sprinted from the church, inwardly hollering, Oh, you had a lovely time, did you? At a funeral? It must have been stress that had caused her to recite the words her mother used to make her practice in the car before she went to a birthday party. Thank you for having me, Mrs. Blake. Smile. Don't hang your head. Look Mrs. Blake in the eyes. I had a lovely time. A lovely time? Her toes were blushing. She had nearly escaped to the freedom of the street when she heard footsteps behind her and felt a touch on her arm. It was Grace. Oh, the mortification of feeling attracted to a man who slept every night with a woman who looked like that. Translucent, flawless skin, clear green eyes, heartbreakingly full lips. They were a different species. If Grace was a gazelle, Sophie was a ground mole. I'm Grace, she said. I don't know if you remember me. I'm Thomas and Veronica's cousin. Callum said you shared a cab today. I just wondered if you'd like to come for lunch next Saturday. Lunch? Repeated Sophie. She had to tip her head back to look at Grace. Her voice sounded hoarse and feeble, as if even her larynx recognized its inferiority. Callum and I are living at my mother's house on the island. I thought it might be nice because... She stopped and seemed to be searching for a reason why it would be nice. Perhaps Rose or Enigma had forced her to issue the invitation. We're going to be neighbours, she finished, and smiled expectantly at Sophie. Her smile was exquisite, but remote. She was like a world-famous celebrity talking by video link to a sycophantic journalist. Sophie wondered why she'd liked Grace so much at Veronica's wedding. She was generally slightly resentful of people who made it obvious they didn't care less whether you liked them or not, because she herself was conscious of an unattractive need to please. Sometimes when talking to somebody, she was suddenly revolted by herself, aware of how eagerly she was leaning forward, chin jutting, mimicking the other person's gestures, moving with them, nodding and smiling, gently nudging their conversation along with a constant stream of appreciative chuckles, soothing hmms, and surprised exclamations. Really? Did he? You're kidding. Love me. Love me. People like Grace didn't change their body language depending on the other person. They set the pace. They stood, elegant and still, while people like Sophie fluttered around them. Well, Sophie wouldn't be doing any fluttering around Grace. Her mother had trained her in the delicate art of suddenly remembering an invented social engagement. Sophie, like Gretel, was extremely good at it, and never even came close to blushing because it was crucial that the other person didn't guess you were faking and have their feelings hurt. "Saturday?" she said brightly. "That would be really nice. I'm sure I'm free." "Oh, no, wait." She crunched her forehead regretfully and gave her handbag an annoyed little slap. "I'm not free. I've got a friend's birthday lunch on that day." "Oh, what a pity. I don't even want to go, to be honest." "Well, perhaps another time."
"Oh, but, well, what about Sunday?" asked Grace. And suddenly she didn't seem cold. She seemed desperate, as if she was pleading for Sophie to come to lunch.
Well, if she was needed, that was different. Sophie felt her heart melt on cue. "You're a soft touch, Soph," her dad, who was the softest touch of all, always told her. She abandoned her mythical such-a-bore barbecue and went straight into normal flutter-like-a-moth mode. "Oh, Sunday would be lovely. It's so nice of you to ask me." So now here she is, driving that familiar route down the freeway, seeing her first glimpses of the river, mysterious slate grey today, beneath a heavy layer of pearly mist hovering just above the water. In just a few short hours, it will all be over, and she will be in the pub with Claire, telling her about it. That's the way to get through today's lunch. It's just a new story to tell Claire. So the worse it is, the better it will be for comedic value. The funeral had provided Claire and her boyfriend Sven with virtually a whole night of entertainment. Actually, thinks Sophie, she seems to spend a lot of her time providing entertainment for her couple friends. They love having Sophie over for dinner, sympathizing with the latest disasters in her life, saying to each other, "There must be someone we can set her up with." The men flirt outrageously with her, and the women tell her they're jealous of her single state. Sophie suspects that after she leaves, they always have better sex than normal. She gets at least one dinner invitation a week. One couple even eagerly suggested she become their flatmate and move into their spare room. For some reason, Sophie is the perfect third partner in a non-sexual ménage à trois. She gives them something they need. She doesn't know what. But it's nice to be helpful. She wonders if Grace and Callum will expect her to fill a similar role. They'd probably love to know about her attraction to Callum. It might invigorate a stale relationship. Although it seems unlikely that women who look like Grace are ever in stale relationships. Rain splatters on the windshield. Sophie puts on the windscreen wipers and leans forward slightly to concentrate more on the road ahead. It's easy to forget to think about driving on these long, straight roads. Yes, Grace had been odd when she issued this lunch invitation. Perhaps she is very shy, or just not a very nice person, or devastated by Aunt Connie's death. Or perhaps she was behaving oddly because Sophie is going to be forced to undergo some bizarre Scribbly Gum Island initiation ceremony, with chanting and incense and walking across hot coals. Or maybe the whole family is going to confront her about Aunt Connie's will. It will be like an intervention or a mock courtroom with Veronica presiding as judge. Sophie will be found guilty, of course. "We find the defendant guilty as charged." They will blindfold her and frog march her to the highest point of the island, where they'll toss her over to certain death on the vicious rocks below. After all, the family is probably perfectly capable of murder. They're all a bit strange. Look at their mysterious history. Look what happened to Alice and Jack, the last non-family members to live on the island. But then, against all odds, Sophie will survive. She'll need extensive plastic surgery, of course, and months later she'll come back even more beautiful than Grace, but essentially still Sophie, to confront them all with their crime. "God, who is that intriguing woman?" Callum will say, peering through his eyeglass, inexplicably dressed and talking like a Regency gentleman. Sophie chuckles out loud in the car at her own fantasies. She has a special, slightly dirty-sounding chuckle she only uses in private. As her mum always says, one of the advantages of being an only child is that you have no trouble amusing yourself. As she pulls off the freeway at the Glass Bay exit, Sophie feels her heart lift, like it did when she was a child and her parents were taking her for a day out on Scribbly Gum. At this point, her father would always make the same joke. "Only another hour to go, Soph." When really, they were only minutes away. Daddy was being a trickster. The opening bars of a new band song comes on the radio, and Sophie quickly flicks up the volume. A good omen. She's been listening out for the song for ages. She's in the early stages of falling in love with it, where she knows the chorus, but not the verses, and she makes up pretend words so she doesn't have to stop singing. She sings lustily, enjoying how stupid she must look to other people, with her mouth opening and shutting and her face twisting in rock star anguish. By the time she pulls in at the ferry wharf, she is in a fine and feisty mood. Chapter 25. Gublet McDublet was running away from home. He'd had enough of Mummy and Daddy and his best friend, Melly the music box dancer. "Leave me alone," he wanted to shout. But you weren't allowed to shout. It wasn't nice. So he was going to live on the moon all by himself. It would be dark and cool and silent. He would be weightless and free, taking giant floating footsteps inside his big spacesuit. Or maybe he would just kill himself. Commit harikari like a Japanese samurai. Or put a gun in his mouth and pull the trigger. He hadn't really decided yet. Grace is brushing Jake's hair for Sophie's visit. It's raining hard now, and Callum has gone down to the wharf to meet her with a big golf umbrella. It's the first time Grace has used the soft little blue hairbrush with the teddy bear on the handle. It came in the huge cellophane-wrapped basket she got from the girls at work. "Oh," everybody said when she held up each new item. The baby seems to like having his hair brushed. He looks up at her with ruminative, wise old man eyes. He has an ugly, pimply rash across both his cheeks, which is apparently very normal, according to Aunt Margie and Enigma. But Grace wishes he didn't have it at the moment. "A face only a mother could love," Ron said the last time he saw him, glancing briefly in the pram, and Grace was filled with a rage so murderous she had to avert her head. She brushes the baby's hair flat, with a part down the side, and his whole face is transformed into that of a 1950s geek. All he needs is the bow tie. She fluffs it back up again, so he looks like a baby. His head is so soft. She imagines smashing his tender head with the side of the hairbrush, again and again and again. He would cry, but he wouldn't try to wriggle away because he doesn't know how. He'd just lie there inert while his head was transformed into a mess of blood and bone. Grace trembles. Her heart races. She stands up with the baby held tightly in her arms and walks rapidly to the pram. She breathes shallow, short breaths as she places him flat on his back. The baby is crying as she walks carefully out of the room and stands in the hallway. She silently pummels her body with clenched fists, punching the tops of her arms and thighs, slapping herself across the cheeks. The pain is exquisite. After about a minute, she stops. Her body aches. Her cheeks sting. She breathes in deeply through her nostrils and then turns her head and practices smiling in the empty hallway. A warm, welcoming smile to no one. The baby wails. Outside, the rain picks up. "It's all right," she says softly to him and to herself. "Everything is going to be all right. I'm going to find a way to fix it." Sophie's coffee and walnut liqueur cake recipe had called for 1 cup of finely chopped walnuts. The sides of the cake are decorated with half walnuts carefully pressed into the icing in a pretty pattern. It is an especially nutty cake, which is unfortunate because Grace has a life-threatening allergy to nuts. If she eats even the tiniest mouthful of Sophie's cake, she'll experience anaphylactic shock. Her mouth and throat will swell up, her heart will race, and she'll collapse. Within seconds, she'll be dead. She has something called an EpiPen, which must be jabbed into her leg, straight through her clothes, giving her a dose of adrenaline. "Wham! Just like that scene in Pulp Fiction," explains Callum, cheerfully demonstrating with his fist. "It's a beautiful cake," says Grace. They are all standing in the kitchen, observing Sophie's deadly offering and listening to the rain, which is now pounding down relentlessly. Grace is holding the baby up over one shoulder. The baby has a single drop of milk hovering on his bottom lip and flushed cheeks. His arms flail. Sophie is entranced by the delicate curve of his floppy, dark head. "All that work you put into baking it," says Grace. "I'm so sorry I can't eat it." "I'm so sorry I brought it," says Sophie, while Claire and Sven guffaw in her head. "It's not your fault," says Callum. "How would you have known?" The thing is that Sophie actually did know about Grace's nut allergy. Both Thomas and Veronica have on different occasions regaled her with the legendary story of Thomas's 16th birthday, when Grace had kissed a boy who had just finished eating 3 satay chicken skewers. There had been a terrifying, exciting race across the river on Uncle Jimmy's speedboat to the waiting ambulance. The boy she'd kissed had been quite traumatized by the event and later turned out to be gay. Apparently, his mother still blamed Grace for what she considered to be her son's unfortunate choice of sexuality. But Sophie had forgotten all about the nut allergy when she'd made the cake. "Actually, I think I did know, but I forgot," she admits, and battles unsuccessfully with a blush. "Too late. Here it comes. Oh, shit." These are the worst situations where she really isn't embarrassed. After all, it's perfectly understandable that she would forget Grace's allergy, and this sort of situation must happen to her all the time. She's like the growing gluten-free, wheat-free, dairy-free brigade, constantly having to say, "Oh no, I couldn't possibly eat that." So, even though it's a bit mortifying that her cake is so conspicuously nutty, she doesn't feel that bad. Unfortunately, the moment there is a likelihood that other people might conceivably think she could feel awkward, she blushes and is therefore embarrassed by the blush, not the original situation. Yes, it is a cruel disorder. Her face throbs. Her neck burns and blotches.
She watches Callum and Grace slide their eyes away to opposite corners of the kitchen. I'll take the twitch next time, thinks Sophie. Thomas and Veronica both told me about the birthday party where you nearly died, she says, talking normally, calling upon 30 years of blushing experience to get her through. Aha! Satay stick boy, crows Callum, and he looks Sophie straight in the eye, grinning, as if she isn't blushing at all. I think Sophie is trying to bump you off, Grace. Lucky we uncovered her cunning plan. The walnuts all over the cake were a bit of a giveaway. Oh, bloody, bloody hell. She really, really likes him. People forget about my stupid nut allergy all the time, says Grace nicely, but still with that perceptible touch of ice. My own mother forgets. Please don't worry about it. Callum can have my piece. I'm still watching what I eat anyway. I'm trying to get back to my pre-pregnancy weight. Grace is wearing jeans and a pristine long-sleeved white shirt. She is tall and slender and utterly perfect. As long as he doesn't kiss you after he eats it, teases Sophie, a bit daringly, as if they are all old friends. She stands there with her scarlet face, like a silly mask, resigned to it. Actually, I never forget Grace's allergy. I'm in a constant state of terror. I'll have to use the EpiPen on her, says Callum. And Sophie, watching him, watching Grace, sees that he truly adores his wife. Well, of course he does. I'll have two, no, three pieces of cake, he continues, just so you don't feel bad, Sophie. But then I'll gargle with disinfectant. A disinfected mouth doesn't sound very kissable, says Sophie. Yes, I think I'd rather risk it with a walnut mouth. Grace smiles, and her whole face is transformed. There is a cozy moment of three-way camaraderie in the kitchen. Oh, dear, thinks Sophie. I think I'm falling in love with both of them. But Grace's smile vanishes like sunlight obliterated by a cloud, and she seems impatient. All right, well, why don't you two go and sit down in the dining room, and I'll just finish off making the lunch. It's a pity the weather is so bad. Otherwise, we could have sat on the balcony. Here, Sophie, would you like to hold the baby? He's just had his feed, so he's in a good mood. Before Sophie can answer, Grace dumps the baby in her arms. Sophie makes a strange, ha, sound and clutches the baby tight. Although she adores babies, she is also terrified of them. As godmother to 9 children, it's very expensive, and 2 of them she secretly dislikes, to her intense shame. She has extensive experience with first-time mothers. Generally, they are quite wearing. Sometimes they hand the baby over, only to immediately snatch it back, and Sophie can always feel their eyes on her and their baby, watching her like a hawk, which only adds to her nervousness. Grace, however, instantly turns her back and is chopping an eggplant into cubes, the knife thudding hard against the cutting board. Thud, thud, thud. Her back in the white shirt is very still. Sophie imagines all the muscles contracted. She feels sudden, unaccountable pity for Grace. What is it, honey? What's the matter? Well, how ridiculous. Grace is a woman leading a dream life. Callum leads Sophie into the dining room. She walks stiffly, imagining tripping or accidentally banging the baby's head against something. She's always slamming her own elbows against doorways. Callum and Grace probably wouldn't be quite as understanding as they were about the walnut cake if she smashed their baby's head. It's a relief when she is seated. The dining room, like the rest of the house, is elegant but austere, like a display home. There isn't enough real stuff lying around. The colours are too neutral. The surfaces too shiny. "Do you like living here?" she asks Callum when she is settled with relief at the table, the baby a comforting weight in the crook of her arm. Callum sits at the head of the table next to her. He is wearing jeans, a long-sleeved shirt with a T-shirt on underneath. His jaw is unshaven, unlike at the funeral. He obviously doesn't shave on the weekends. He's a big, lumbering lump of a man, really, but there is just something delicious about him. "Oh, for heaven's sake, Sophie, get a grip! You obviously need to have sex with somebody, anybody, very soon. Celibacy is sending you mad. If you blush again, I'll murder you." "I like living on the island," says Callum. "It's great. I'm not so fussed about living in my mother-in-law's house. It's all a bit stiff and clean for me. I grew up in a house with 6 boys." 5 brothers? Surely one of them is single. Another version of him, an identical twin, perhaps. Perfect. She hadn't made such a mistake in the cab. She'd just had a slight, understandable mix-up between brothers. "Yep, I'm the baby. We're all married with kids now. Jake is the youngest of 16 grandchildren." "Of course not. There is no such thing as a single man. They're all gone. They were sold out by the early 90s. "Gosh, 15 cousins. Callum is refilling Sophie's wine glass with the Sauvignon Blanc. He takes a sip from his own glass and smacks his lips. "Even a Philistine like me can tell this is a really good wine. I've been trained since birth. My parents used to take me on wine tasting trips for school holidays." "That's the difference. My parents took me to Budgerwoy Caravan Park. Were you a spoiled little princess?" "If you hid a pea under my mattress, I wouldn't sleep a wink." "This is most certainly not chemistry. This is a beautiful woman's husband who is so happily married he can afford to be nice to plain single women." Sophie looks down at the baby and finds herself doing that thing women do where they ask babies who can't talk questions meant for other people. "Who do you look like, Jake? Your mum or your dad?" Callum obligingly answers her, leaning forward to look at the baby in Sophie's arms. She can smell his aftershave. "I'm hoping he'll get Grace's looks rather than mine, for obvious reasons. I don't think he really looks like either of us at the moment. I think he most closely resembles an elderly monkey." "A little monkey, eh?" Sophie bares her teeth in a monkey face and makes a chattering sound at Jake. The baby looks up at her with wandering dark eyes, and all of a sudden they pause, and it's like he's caught sight of his first ever fellow human being. His eyes lock onto hers, and a corner of his mouth curves up tentatively in a wonky attempt at a grin. "Was that a smile?" Callum leans forward on his chair, his arm pressing against Sophie's. "I think that was his first smile." Jake's eyes waver and then focus on Callum. He gives his father an even bigger, lopsided smile. This time his eyes crinkle at the corners. Callum almost tips forward off the chair in ecstasy. "Hello there, mate. You don't look like a monkey at all. No, you're a good-looking guy." There is a tender, teary feeling in Sophie's chest. Grace walks in at that moment, carrying a gigantic platter of food. Callum grabs Grace around the waist. "He smiled at us. You should have seen it. Sophie made a monkey face and he smiled for the first time. Do it again, Sophie. Feeling like an idiot, Sophie makes a half-hearted monkey noise, thinking, I'm sure she's really going to appreciate missing her baby's first smile. But the effort of trying out brand new facial movements has obviously tired Jake out, and he is suddenly fractious. As Grace leans towards him, he throws back his small head and gives a screeching, red-faced wail. Oh, says Grace. Sophie expects her to take the baby from her, but she just gives a wintry smile and sits down on the other side of the dining room table, indicating the platter. Just a few starters. Those ones are tuna spring rolls, that's bruschetta, of course, and those there are egg rolls with smoked salmon. The rest is self-explanatory, I think. Gosh, says Sophie feebly. The baby continues to cry, and she experiments gamely with a few ineffectual rocking motions. Let me take him so you can eat, says Callum. He casually swoops the baby up and out of Sophie's arms and plonks him over one broad shoulder, rapidly patting his large, nappied bottom. The baby whimpers a bit and then stops crying. Callum caresses the back of Jake's downy head and says, You'll have to smile for your mum later, or she'll think we made it up. Grace is not even looking at her baby. Sophie has seen all types of new mothers, the ones with besotted, glazed-over eyes, the cool, casual, this-is-a-piece-of-cake types, the teary, terrified ones, and the exhausted, overwhelmed ones who speak obsessively of how many hours' sleep they managed the night before. Grace doesn't seem to fit in any of these categories. She's like a woman playing a mother in a moisturizer commercial. Actually, thinks Sophie, she's quite weird. Sophie hears herself start to gush. This food looks wonderful, Grace. That's so impressive when you have a new baby. I have some friends who say they don't even have time to get dressed in the morning or go to the toilet or comb their hair. Oh, well, none of this was very difficult. Grace's family take food very seriously, says Callum. He takes an enormous bite of an egg roll. It's like my family and music. What's your family's obsession, Sophie? I don't know if we've got one. Oh, yes, I know. We're hedonists. We take pleasure very seriously. My parents have always meticulously planned their weekends for maximum pleasure. They sound great, says Callum. My parents get nervy if things are going too well for too long. What's the opposite of hedonism? Says Grace. Masochism, I guess. That's my mother. She plans her life for maximum misery. She's smiling at Sophie, folding a piece of prosciutto in half and wrapping it around a sun-dried tomato. She is not weird at all. She is perfectly normal. Sophie is obviously prejudiced because of her beauty. Beautiful people probably suffer from terrible discrimination, just like other minority groups. Sophie should think of Grace's beauty as a handicap, like blushing. Ha ha. Isn't your mum travelling around the world at the moment? Asks Sophie. That doesn't sound too masochistic. Everywhere is just too dirty, too expensive, too hot, or just too different. She's revelling in a sort of exotic international misery now. I think he's dropped off. Callum turns his shoulder slightly to show them Jake's flushed, sleeping face. I'll put him down. No, no, says Grace. I'll do it. She disappears from the room with Jake and is gone for ages. Callum refills Sophie's glass again and starts interrogating her about her taste in music. She receives a thumbs up for Cowboy Junkies,
a quizzical eyebrow for Pearl Jam, and a pained wince for Shania Twain. When she reveals that she has the soundtrack to Titanic, he writhes, waving his arms at her to stop while he chokes on a mouthful of wine. They are laughing when Grace comes back into the room and immediately stop and turn expansively towards her, smiling too eagerly to make sure she knows they've been having a good time, but not too good a time. Titanic, explains Sophie inadequately. I'm afraid our guest has shocking taste in music, says Callum. Oh, well, I can't even converse about music, says Grace, sitting down. That's not true, says Callum. Yes, it is. Grace immediately stands up again. I'll get the main course now, she says. Sit down, says Callum. Let me get it. You've been rushing around all day. What can I do to help? Sophie is half out of her chair. No, no. Grace quells them both like over-eager puppies. You stay. Chat. So they stay. And they get onto the music of their youth. 80s music. Wham, Duran Duran, Boy George, Madonna. They sing lines of songs to each other. They keep exploding with laughter. They discover they were at the same pseudo-echo concert back in 1986. It was probably my destiny to meet him at that concert, thinks Sophie. Just my luck. I was in the toilet, readjusting my shoulder pads. It's turning into one of those conversations at a party where you've both got just the right amount of alcohol in your bloodstreams and you're making each other laugh, and you both know you fancy each other, and you're ignoring the party happening around you, and you're so pleased because he didn't want to come in the first place, and any minute now you're heading for first kiss time, and you know that after he kisses you, he's most definitely going to ask for your phone number, and he's most definitely going to call. Only it's not one of those conversations, because this type of euphoric tableau does not normally incorporate a beautiful wife in the kitchen fixing lunch or a sleeping baby son down the hallway. This is getting just the tiniest bit dangerous. They are flirting with the idea of flirting. What is Grace doing? Wine at lunchtime goes straight to my head, says Sophie suddenly, as if she's explaining something. Me too. I'll get us some water, says Callum, as if he's explaining something back. And as he stands up, his eyes meet hers with a fleeting, uncomfortable glance. And Sophie knows, the way you just know some things without question, that in another parallel world, he would have asked for her phone number if she'd met him at the pseudo-echo concert or the imaginary party. She didn't imagine the chemistry in the cab. It's just bad luck. There is a sudden rapping on the glass windows of the dining room. Yoo-hoo! Callum and Sophie both jump. Two figures are outside on the balcony, tapping on the windows with their umbrella handles as they walk past them towards the front door. Enigma and Aunt Rose. Callum is smiling with something that looks suspiciously like relief. Enigma and Rose come into the dining room, awkwardly peeling off sopping wet bright yellow raincoats, squeezing out water from their straggled hair, puffing, pink and wrinkled. They are obviously rather exhilarated by their daring as they say things like, "Torrential! I couldn't see a thing! We're absolutely drenched!" They collapse on the sofa, full of themselves and their adventure, like prematurely aged teenagers. We hooned over on our bikes, dear, explains Enigma to Sophie. We're real hoons. Oh, my word, is that a nice white wine there, I see? Rose and I will have a glass, won't we, Rose? I think there's going to be the most tremendous storm, says Rose. I love storms, especially thunder. That big, powerful boom, kaboom, as if something is breaking. Connie loved storms too. When we were young, we used to run around the island when there was a storm. Sometimes we took our clothes off. You'll see wonderful storms from Connie's balcony, Sophie. Callum hands them both glasses of wine, and Sophie sees that Rose's hands are trembling slightly. Grace appears in the doorway. "You two will catch pneumonia," she says. "You sound just like your mother, dear," says Enigma. "Are you staying for lunch?" asks Grace. "Oh, no, dear, we wouldn't dream of it. We just stopped in to say hello to Sophie," says Enigma. "What have you made?" "Mum's salmon risotto."
"Ah, Laura's risotto with the goat's cheese. Well, we'd only need small portions, wouldn't we, Rose? We eat like little birds these days."
"It's okay, there's plenty. Will you get them towels, Callum? They've got to get dry. Maybe you should both use my hairdryer." Sophie watches Grace and Callum share a husbandly, wifely look. They will laugh and complain about this unexpected visit in bed tonight.
"I'll give both their heads a good rub," promises Callum. "Oh, you," says Enigma coquettishly.
When Callum and Grace are out of the room, Rose and Enigma lean forward confidentially towards Sophie.
"We've brought you the keys to Connie's house," says Enigma.
Sophie is a bit thrown. She has an appointment to see Connie's solicitor on Tuesday. She had assumed the whole process would take weeks. There's also the Veronica issue.
"But, Veronica mentioned that maybe the family wasn't too happy about Aunt Connie leaving the house to me."
"Oh, she's a rascal, that Veronica," says Rose fondly. "You mustn't take any notice of her," says Enigma. "I often sing a little song in my head until she's finished talking. The thing is, Rose and I think it would be fun if you moved into the house quite soon."
"But won't there be paperwork?" asks Sophie.
"Oh, but we don't like paperwork," says Enigma. "No need to dilly-dally. Sooner the better."
"You won't be lonely," says Rose. "And the garden needs you."
"We'll drop in on you," says Enigma, "as often as you like."
Rose smiles radiantly at her.
"And when you turn 40, we'll tell you the truth about Alice and Jack."
Enigma starts and looks terrified.
"Good Lord, Rose, have you gone stark raving mad?"
"Oh, I haven't mixed up the ages, have I?
40? Yes, no, that's right, Enigma. Connie said we'll tell them when they're 40. "Yes, but we don't tell them we're going to tell them, do we?"
Enigma is agitated. She gulps at her wine and turns to Sophie.
"You must excuse Rose, pet," she says. "She's so upset about Connie. She's not herself. She's talking gibberish, of course."
"It's okay," says Sophie. So they actually know what happened to Alice and Jack. Wait till she tells her parents. Does Veronica know? Veronica isn't 40, so presumably not.
Enigma says, "I need to ask a favor, dear."
"Of course."
"I need to ask you not to mention what Rose just said to anybody. It's all a nonsense, of course, but it could upset the family. This is quite serious, although not at all serious, of course, but still, you need to keep it a secret, dear."
"Keep what a secret?" asks Callum, his arms full of towels.
"Secret women's business," says Sophie, and she gives Enigma a wink.
Outside, the rain sounds harder, pelleting against the roof, as if someone has increased the volume.
"That's hail," says Rose. "It's exciting, but it flattens the flowers. Connie won't like that.
Chapter 26.
Margie is at her Weight Watchers meeting, listening to a woman tell the story of her amazing weight loss journey. The woman has lost 60 kilos. A whole person. There has been a 4-page article about her in the Australian Woman's Weekly. She is in the running for the Weight Watcher of the Year. She is an inspiration. A movie star. She was a size 22 in a caftan. Now she is a size 8 in leather pants. The whole room is mesmerized by those shiny black leather pants. "I despised myself when I was fat," says the woman, holding toned, skinny arms wide. "You should have heard my self-talk. I used to wake up each morning and say to my reflection, 'Good morning, slovenly sow.'" Everyone laughs, slightly quivery laughs. Does anyone else do that? Negative self-talk? "I don't need self-talk," contributes a pretty woman who is about the same age as Margie's daughter, Veronica. She has round apple cheeks and hurt eyes. "I have husband talk. He calls me Chubby Chops. He's not exactly Brad Pitt, either." "I'll bet he isn't," a man cries out angrily at the other end of the aisle. And when everyone turns to look at him, he suddenly looks horrified. "Oh, I don't mean that you... I meant that in a good way." "Oh, just leave your husband, darling," thinks Margie. "You could marry that nice man and have lots of dear, plump children together." "So what I did was change my self-talk," says the woman, whirling around to give them a glimpse of her neat leather buttocks. "Instead of saying, 'Good morning, slovenly sow,' when I looked in the morning, I changed it to, 'Good morning, sexy goddess.' You know why? I'll tell you why. Because the body believes the mind." The man sitting next to Margie shifts uncomfortably in his chair and lowers his chin. "Ms. Leatherpants is getting a bit tiresome now, don't you think?" The man has a bright red face and layers of chins. Ron would call him a heart attack waiting to happen. Margie looks around nervously. She never talked in class at school, but she doesn't want to be rude to this poor man. His heart attack might happen. And it's nice of him to try and be funny like that. Daringly, she whispers back, "Yes, she is a bit." He lowers his chin again and Margie is frantic. "That's enough. We'll get into trouble." She looks straight ahead with bright attention at the speaker. The man wheezes into her ear. "Would you like to have a skim cappuccino with me after the meeting?" "Good Lord! Surely he isn't trying to pick her up, as they say. He's probably just lonely. Perhaps he wants to sell her some business opportunity. Or he's a Christian. Or he might be a dangerous kook." "All right," she whispers back. Sophie and her mother are at the Korean bathhouse in the city. They've been coming here for years, since Sophie was a teenager. First, they have a full body scrub, followed by a long, languid soak in the baths, then yum cha in Chinatown, shopping, and a cocktail or two at the opera bar. They sit in one of the hot baths, their heads resting against the wall. Naked female forms stroll through the steam, lowering themselves into the water. Everyone covertly checks out everyone else's bodies through half-lowered eyelashes. Sophie is telling her mother about how she got Jake to smile for the first time. "He's adorable," she says. "You sound very clucky." Gretel's hair has gone into corkscrew curls in the heat, and she has hectic pink circles on her cheeks. "I guess I am a bit," says Sophie, and she's shocked by a sudden swell of grief. "But I'm just going to have to accept it, aren't I? I'm not going to be a mother. When I think about my 40th birthday, it's like a big iron door slamming in my face. There just isn't time to meet somebody, and I know that's just life. But sometimes, Mum, I just ache for a child." "Oh, Sophie." Gretel sits upright and agitatedly pats her shoulder. "Sweetheart, of course there's time. We just have to fix this. I didn't realize it meant so much to you, darling. I'm so stupid. I thought you were happy being a career girl. Oh, dear. How can we fix this?" She looks around her frantically, as if a spare baby is likely to go floating by any second, and she can quickly scoop it up and hand it over to Sophie. A woman, a sleek brunette sitting close to them, leans over confidentially and says, "I hope you don't mind me listening in, but I've got a friend who is single and wants a baby, and she's doing it on her own. She just said, 'Bugger it. This is what I want.' And off she went to the sperm bank. Picked out a donor. He's tall with red hair, and his interests are scuba diving, Thai cooking, and playing the violin. My friend said she always dreamed of having a red-headed baby." "Goodness," blinks Gretel. "What a pity she couldn't meet the red-headed sperm donor at a Thai cooking course and fall in love with him," says Sophie. "Ah, you're a romantic," says the brunette. "I bet you believe in fate and all that crap." She elbows the woman sitting next to her. "Give her a reading, Caitlin." "Caitlin is a psychic," she explains. "She's very accurate." Caitlin doesn't open her eyes. "Would you like it if I went around suggesting you give people a free haircut? If people want a reading, they can make an appointment and see me at my offices." The sleek brunette is unfazed. "Oh, don't be a bitch. Give her a sample of your wares." "It's okay," says Sophie. "Thanks anyway." Caitlin groans and heaves herself up to squint at Sophie. "You've got a strong aura," she says irritably. "Oh, well done, darling," says Gretel. "What colour is it?" asks the sleek brunette. The psychic squints. It's caramel." "Oh, a caramel-coloured aura." Gretel is enchanted. "That sounds delicious. What does it mean?"
Well, it generally means a positive career change."
"Oh." Gretel looks disappointed. "We're not so interested in her career. What about her love life?"
The psychic sighs heavily and says, "Give me a palm." I'm really fine," says Sophie. "Perhaps I'll get your number and make a proper appointment to see you." But Caitlin takes her hand in a firm, professional grasp. "Okay," she says tiredly. "You've got an excellent lifeline. Very strong."
"Oh, yes, she's always been very healthy," says Gretel.
"Now, your fate line is strong too, but with lots of breaks. So, in other words, you're overcoming barriers."
"That's right! She's overcome lots of barriers," said Gretel sagely, as though Sophie was paralyzed and had to learn to walk again at one point in her life.
"Okay. Your heart line. Now, that's not so good. It's all over the place. I'd say your love life is a real fiasco."
"Thanks," says Sophie.
"What about kids?" asks the brunette. "Is she going to have kids?" The psychic pulls Sophie's palm closer to her face and shakes her head regretfully.
Gosh. You know, I've never seen anything like it. See, under your pinky, this is where you're meant to have lines indicating your potential number of children. Well, you've just got completely smooth skin.
Okay, that's enough.
Gretel grabs Sophie's hand. You couldn't possibly read her palm properly when it's all pruny from the water. Come on, Sophie, it's time for us to go.
Typical. People only want to hear good news, shrugs the psychic, subsiding back against the side of the pool.
Charlatan!
Gretel hops out of the pool, quivering with maternal indignation. Come on, darling, it's time for yum-cha!
Sophie meekly follows her mother to the changing rooms, where her knees finally give way and she dissolves into helpless giggles, only made worse by her mother furiously muttering things like, I'll give her a caramel aura.
Veronica is doing boxer size for the broken-hearted. It's an aerobics class at her local gym, especially for people recovering from bad relationship breakups. The room reeks of fresh, sweaty misery. Veronica loves it. Grim-faced men and women work out to angry, punch-the-air sorts of songs like, You ought to know, I will survive, and these boots were made for walking. The teacher yells ordinary instructions like, Lift those knees, interspersed with motivational comments like, It's time to move on. They do boxing exercises where they are encouraged to imagine assaulting their ex-partners. Left hook, right hook. They hurt you, hurt them back. Smash their skulls in. Jab, jab, kick. Afterwards, during the cool down, the teacher's voice switches to tender. Stretch your right hamstring and release your anger. Stretch your left hamstring and know that you are strong. Breathe in, breathe out. It's time for a new beginning. Often, there is a piteous sob from the back of the classroom. Veronica normally leaves before this part. She doesn't think it's necessary to cool down. She started doing the class 2 years ago, after the morning her husband Jonas gave her a funny, sad look and said, Don't you think we better get a divorce? He was handing her a cup of tea at the time. She slopped it all over her hand and burned herself. I don't know what you want, Veronica, he'd said, but I know it's not me. Most people only need to come to boxercise for the broken-hearted for a couple of months before that crazed look in their eyes starts to fade. Their jabs become less vicious and more comical. They start smiling instead of scowling, which isn't nice for the newly broken-hearted. Eventually, they stop coming and take their healed hearts back to the cheery classes like Move and Groove. But Veronica still comes, week after week. Her broken heart may have healed, but she can always find something or someone to be angry about. She's angry with that snooty market research woman who told her last night she talked too much in the focus group about tinned tuna. Wasn't that the point? Wasn't that what she was being paid for? To give her opinions? She's angry with the man who swerved into her lane on the way to the gym and raised an apologetic hand, as if that made it okay. She's angry with that Asian girl in the red and green top over there who consistently kicks with the opposite leg to the rest of the class and doesn't seem to notice. She's angry with Sophie for being so manipulative and cutesy. Grace for being so beautiful. Aunt Connie for being so patronizing and now so dead. Aunt Rose for being so dippy, Grandma Enigma for being so cheery, Thomas for being so sappy, Mum for being so fat and tragic, Dad for being so cruel to Mum. She's angry with her third grade teacher and the woman who fitted her for her first bra.
She combines them all into one giant sumo wrestler of humanity and punches him again and again in his big flabby stomach. "Ha!" yells Veronica with the rest of the class, doing a jump kick followed by a slice to the neck. Her sumo wrestler flinches, but doesn't fall. On the way home in the car, still puffing from her workout, Veronica listens to a radio interview with a criminal psychologist who is talking about the difference between male and female serial murderers. Veronica turns up the radio. She is interested in murder. "Men stalk, women lure," says the criminal psychologist. "So we lure our victims with our irresistible feminine wiles," says the interviewer irresistibly. "You could put it like that. In fact, you tend to already know your victims," says the criminal psychologist, apparently happy to let the interviewer act as a representative of female serial killers. "Aha! Watch out for your wives and girlfriends, listeners," says the interviewer. Veronica shouts at the radio, "Shut up, you fatuous twit, you moronic cow. This is interesting. You tend to smother or poison your victims," says the criminal psychologist. "Ooh, here's a lovely dinner I've baked for you, honey," chortles the interviewer. Veronica gives the car radio a left hook, and it really hurts her hand. She hadn't intended to connect. She turns off the radio and pulls up with a screech of brakes at a red light. She hates this intersection. The traffic lights are clearly faulty. Her lane is always treated unfairly. Look at that. The fools doing a right hand into Condamine Street have had two green lights in the time she's been sitting here. She's already written once to council about it. Perhaps it's time for a visit. Personal confrontation seems to be very effective when dealing with bureaucrats. Afterwards, she will be fascinated by the complex workings of her own brain. Because there she is, busily pondering the issue of faulty traffic lights, while simultaneously her smarter, more intuitive subconscious mind is considering the topic of murder. And then, without warning, her subconscious lobs a clear, precise, perfectly articulated thought straight into her consciousness. It's not so much a thought as a fundamental truth, a truth she has probably always known somewhere deep within her psyche, ever since she was a small child and first heard the so obviously fabricated story of Alice and Jack. Aunt Connie was most definitely a murderer. Well, of course she was. Alice and Jack didn't just vanish. They were murdered. Poison, probably, artfully sprinkled on cinnamon toast. Veronica smiles, oblivious to the fact that the lights have changed and the car behind her is tooting with increasing irritation. Chapter 27. I Want My Ashes Scattered One Night at the Stroke of Midnight by Rose and Enigma at Kingfisher Lookout. No, it is not necessary for any of you younger ones to accompany them, thank you. They are perfectly capable. Afterwards, they can celebrate with a feast of my cinnamon.